Chapter 27. The Big Meadow. Winter arrived early that year. Like the children, I anticipated the first snowfall, but with a quiet sense of dread, wondering how Marley could make it through another tough winter. One blustery Sunday night in mid-December, when the children had finished their homework, Jenny started the popcorn on the stove and declared a family movie night. I got the fire humming as the kids queued up the video. I lay down on the floor and propped my head on a pillow, more watching the fire than the movie. Marley couldn't resist this opportunity. His favorite human was at ground level, utterly defenseless. Soon he was pressed up against me, grinding his head into my ribs. The minute I reached out to pet him, it was all over. He pushed himself up on his paws, shook hard, showering me in loose fur, and stared down at me, his billowing jowls hanging immediately over my face. When I started to laugh, he took this as a green light to advance, and before I quite knew what was happening, he had straddled my chest with his front paws and, in one big free fall, collapsed on top of me in a heap. "Ah!" I screamed under his weight. "Full frontal lab attack!" The kid squealed. Marley could not believe his good fortune. I wasn't even trying to get him off me. He squirmed, he drooled, he licked me all over the face and nuzzled my neck. I could barely breathe under his weight, and after a few minutes, I slid him half off me, where he remained through most of the movie, his head, shoulder, and one paw resting on my chest, the rest of him pressed against my side. I didn't say so to anyone in the room, but I found myself clinging to the moment, knowing there would not be too many more like it. Marley was in the quiet dusk of a long and eventful life. Looking back on it later, I would recognize that night in front of the fire for what it was, our farewell party. 4 days later, we packed the minivan in preparation for a family vacation to Disney World in Florida. It would be the children's first Christmas away from home, and they were wild with excitement. That evening, in preparation for an early morning departure, Jenny delivered Marley to the veterinarian's office, where she had arranged for him to spend our week away in the intensive care unit, where the doctors and workers could keep their eyes on him around the clock, and where he would not be riled by the other dogs. After his close call on their watch the previous summer, they were happy to give him the Cadillac Digs and extra attention at no extra cost. Ridiculing the whole Disney experience is a favorite sport, but the whole family had a wonderful time, even naysayer Dad. We spent much of the long drive back recounting the pros and cons of each ride, each swim, each moment. We were halfway through Maryland, just 4 hours from home, when my cell phone rang. It was one of the workers from the veterinarian's office. Marley was acting lethargic, she said, and his hips were worse than usual. She said the vet wanted our permission to give him a steroid shot and pain medication. "Sure," I said, "keep him comfortable, and we'd be there to pick him up the next day." When Jenny arrived to take him home the following afternoon, December 29th, Marley looked tired and a little out of sorts, but not visibly ill. But within a half hour of getting him home, he was retching, trying to clear thick mucus from his throat. Jenny let him out into the front yard, and he simply lay on the frozen ground and could not or would not budge. She called me at work in a panic. "I can't get him back inside," she said. "He's lying out there in the cold, and he won't get up." I left immediately, and by the time I arrived home 45 minutes later, she had managed to get him to his feet and back into the house. I found him sprawled on the dining room floor, distressed and clearly not himself. I knelt down beside him and rubbed his snout. No reaction. He did not try to gum my wrist, did not want to play, did not even lift his head. His eyes were far away, and his tail lay limp on the floor. After several minutes, Marley slowly stood up on shaky legs and tried to retch again, but nothing would come out. That's when I noticed his stomach. It looked bigger than usual, and it was hard to the touch. My heart sank. I knew what this meant. I called the veterinarian's office. The receptionist said, "The doctor says to bring him right in." Jenny and I did not have to say a word to each other. We both understood that the moment had arrived. We braced the kids, telling them Marley had to go to the hospital, and the doctors were going to try to make him better, but that he was very sick. As I was getting ready to go, I looked in, and Jenny and the kids were huddled around him as he lay on the floor, so clearly in distress, making their goodbyes. They each got to pet him and have a few last moments with him. The children remained bullishly optimistic that this dog, who had been a constant part of their lives, would soon be back, good as new. "Get all better, Marley," Colleen said in her little voice. With Jenny's help, I got him into the back of my car. She gave him a last quick hug, and I drove off, one hand on the wheel and the other stretched behind me so I could stroke his head and shoulders. "Oh, Marley," I just kept saying. In the parking lot of the animal hospital, I helped him out of the car, and he stopped to sniff a tree where the other dogs all pee, still curious despite how ill he felt. I gave him a minute, knowing this might be his last time in his beloved outdoors, then tugged gently at his choker chain and led him into the lobby. Just inside the front door, he decided he had gone far enough and gingerly let himself down on the tile floor. When the techs and I were unable to get him back to his feet, they brought out a stretcher, slid him onto it, and disappeared with him behind the counter, heading for the examining area. A few minutes later, the vet, a young woman I had never met before, came out and led me into an exam room where she put a pair of X-ray films up on a light board. She showed me how his stomach had bloated to twice its normal size. On the film, near where the stomach meets the intestines, she traced two fist-sized dark spots, which she said indicated a twist. Just as with the last time, she said she would sedate him and insert a tube into his stomach to release the gas causing the bloating. She would then use the tube to manually feel for the back of the stomach. "It's a long shot," she said, "but I'm going to try to use the tube to massage his stomach back into place." It was exactly the same 1% gamble Dr. Hopkinson had given over the summer. It had worked once. It could work again. I remained silently optimistic. "Okay," I said. "Please give it your best shot." A half hour later, she emerged with a grim face. She had tried 3 times and was unable to open the blockage. She had given him more sedatives in the hope they might relax his stomach muscles. When none of that worked, she had inserted a catheter through his ribs, a last-ditch attempt to clear the blockage, also without luck. "At this point," she said, "our only real option is to go into surgery." She paused, as if gauging whether I was ready to talk about the inevitable, and then said, "Or the most humane thing might be to put him to sleep." Jenny and I had been through this decision 5 months earlier and had already made the hard choice. My visit to Shanksville had only solidified my resolve not to subject Marley to any more suffering. Yet standing in the waiting room, the hour upon me once again, I stood frozen. The doctor sensed my agony and discussed the complications that could likely be expected in operating on a dog of Marley's age. Another thing troubling her, she said, was a bloody residue that had come out on the catheter, indicating problems with the stomach wall. "Who knows what we might find when we get in there," she said. I told her I wanted to step outside to call my wife. On the cell phone in the parking lot, I told Jenny that they had tried everything short of surgery to no avail. We sat silently on the phone for a long moment before she said, "I love you, John." "I love you too, Jenny." I walked back inside and asked the doctor if I could have a couple of minutes alone with him. She warned me that he was heavily sedated. "Take all the time you need," she said. I found him unconscious on the stretcher, on the floor, an IV shunt in his forearm. I got down on my knees and ran my fingers through his fur the way he liked. I ran my hand down his back. I lifted each floppy ear in my hands, those crazy ears that had caused him so many problems over the years and cost us a king's ransom, and felt their weight. I pulled his lip up and looked at his lousy, worn-out teeth. I picked up a front paw and cupped it in my hand. Then I dropped my forehead against his and sat there for a long time, as if I could telegraph a message through our two skulls, from my brain to his. I wanted to make him understand some things. "You know all that stuff we've always said about you, what a total pain you are? Don't believe it. Don't believe it for a minute, Marley." He needed to know that, and something more, too. There was something I had never told him, that no one ever had. I wanted him to hear it before he went. "Marley," I said, "you are a great doc." I found the doctor waiting at the front counter. "I'm ready," I said. My voice was cracking, which surprised me because I had really believed I'd braced myself months earlier for this moment. I knew if I said another word, I would break down, and so I just nodded and signed as she handed me release forms. When the paperwork was completed, I followed her back to the unconscious Marley, and I knelt in front of him again, my hands cradling his head as she prepared a syringe and inserted it into the shunt. "Are you okay?" she asked. I nodded, and she pushed the plunger. His jaw shuddered ever so slightly. She listened to his heart and said it had slowed way down, but not stopped. He was a big dog. She prepared a second syringe and again pushed the plunger. A minute later, she listened again and said, "He's gone." She left me alone with him, and I gently lifted one of his eyelids. She was right. Marley was gone. I walked out to the front desk and paid the bill. A few minutes later, she and an assistant wheeled out a cart with a large black bag on it and helped me lift it into the back seat. The doctor shook my hand, told me how sorry she was. She had done her best, she said. "It was his time," I said, then thanked her and drove away. In the car on the way home, I started to cry, something I almost never do, not even at funerals. It only lasted a few minutes. By the time I pulled into the driveway, I was dry-eyed again. I left Marley in the car and went inside where Jenny was sitting up waiting. The children were all in bed asleep. We would tell them in the morning. We fell into each other's arms and both started weeping. Later, we went outside and together lifted the heavy black bag out of the car and into the garden cart, which I rolled into the garage for the night.